Two faces have
tonight. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. How many times has somebody said to you, management doesn't have a clue? let's see, I've worked in broadcasting for how many years now? 16 years? I think I've heard that from the very beginning and in other fields as well. Dr. Mike Armour joins us now and actually has such a terrific book. I really spent the whole weekend, when I read the book from cover to cover over the weekend, we got sports going on, this is a good thing. The book is called Leadership and the Power of Trust. Dr. Mike, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I was really honest about that. I got some great things from your book, and that was one thing I pulled out. I thought, oh, how funny. You don't know how many times that I have heard that. I wonder, what is it? It seems to be worse now. Are people less trusting in America than ever before?
Well, there are a tremendous number of surveys that indicate that, and they're not surveys that are coming from partisan interests with an axe to grind. They are surveys from the academic world. There are surveys from companies that specialize in human relations consulting. And across the board, for the last 7 or 8 or 9 years, those surveys are showing trust both in corporate America and across all of the institutions in America being at an all-time low.
What happens to corporations, small companies, any kind of an organization when there are huge trust deficits, Doc?
Well, immediately, you begin to be impaired in the three things that I consider absolute musts for companies that are going to remain in a competitive position today. That is, the three things that you must have going for you to stay ahead of the pack are speed, the speed with which you develop new products and get those products to market, agility, your ability to adjust quickly when the circumstances in which you're competing change, and innovation. And when trust is in low supply, or when distrust, to look at it another way, is prominent, it bogs down communication, it promotes turf guarding, it cuts back on the confidence people have to advance a bold new idea, fear and anxiety are dominant, and those kinds of emotions then impair the ability to be fast, agile, and innovative.
You know, there's something that you talked about, too, in your book, and you asked the question, answer it. What makes trust so fragile for all of us?
It seems that we are wired to be extremely cautious as a creature. This probably goes back to the needs we had in a more primitive society, where we had to depend upon our own resources and our own ingenuity to survive. If you got in trouble, there was no dialing up 911 and getting some help immediately. And so we tend to be super sensitized at even an unconscious level to things that seem to be a threat to us. As a result, it takes a lot less to destroy trust than it takes to build it. Warren Buffett said one time, it takes 20 years to build trust and 10 minutes to destroy it. The sad thing is that once trust is damaged, it takes far more work to rebuild it than it took to create it in the first place.
Yeah, boy, no kidding. You have a great formula. You talk about this. You talk about feeling safe, informed, respected, valued, and understood. And what you say in your book, and this is in Chapter 15, that it corresponds to what we need to experience in order to be comfortable with any circle of people. That is dead on, Dr. Mike. And I don't understand why some of these people with Harvard degrees and Wharton School degrees, and I've worked in businesses and I've seen this, and I've had heads of companies sit me down and say, geez, what am I doing wrong? And they miss half of this formula. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because our education, particularly our management education for the last 20 or 30 years, has emphasized the development of quantitative tools and assessing the health of an organization entirely on the basis of measurable outputs, measurable efficiencies, bottom line issues. Leaders are not trained in business school on how to read the emotional field that's running in their company, or how to make that field healthier if they discover that it's not as productive as it needs to be. As a result, we're beginning to see an awakening to the need for this with the work by people like Daniel Goleman and his work on emotional intelligence and his more recent book, Social Intelligence, in which he's addressing this blind spot as it's found all across the management world. But when you do find a leader who understands this and who is building an emotional culture that is one in which people feel safe, informed, respected, valued, and understood, you will also discover a leader that people will go to bat for no matter what and will help him or her succeed.
Doc, obviously that you caught onto this early, because I didn't give you enough of an introduction. You've got degrees from five colleges and various universities, PhD from UCLA. You've worked in all kinds of fields. You were a university dean, a college president, a Navy captain, a congressional candidate, an executive in all kinds of nonprofit and faith-based organizations. And did you discover this early as you went along, and this is what's compiled and what you've realized with this book?
Yes, I think I had the blessing of developing a lot of my leadership experience early on in volunteer organizations, where there is very little by way of leverage that a leader has to keep people involved and doing their best to achieve the goals of the organization, other than the quality of the relationship between the leader and those volunteers. And so in that setting, you pay a lot more attention to the emotional field that is running within your organization than might be the case if you were running a retail business or some other commercial enterprise. And so that got me thinking about it. Where it really came home to roost was when I was 37 and became president of a small liberal arts college that was literally on the verge of bankruptcy.
Mm.
And I came in to see if I could effect a turnaround. And I very quickly realized that if people were going to stick with me through the very difficult days of the turnaround, it was going to be because they had deep trust in me and had, therefore, some hope that their sacrifice would pay off in the long run. And that I really didn't have any other power other than the power they gave me by investing their trust in me. I couldn't bring the fortune in terms of finances to bear immediately that was needed to reverse the situation. I couldn't afford to fire anybody because I didn't have enough money to hire their replacement. So I couldn't use fear techniques to get cooperation. What I had to do was to create an environment in which trust was so high within our organization that people would feel good about going the second, third, and fourth mile to help us make the turnaround. And the real eye-opener for me was to realize early in the going that though we have always said that we earn trust, the truth of the matter is trust like beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. That is, I can't do anything to compel someone to trust me. Trust is something that they voluntarily invest in me, and that I've got to approach this trust building not so much in terms of earning trust, but conducting myself in such a way that I make it as easy as possible for those that I'm asking to follow me to invest their trust in me.
Yeah, well put. Fascinating book, and